Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seechangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. And today is episode 132 with the title Inclusivity in the Digital Age. And I have the absolute honour and privilege to welcome Luke Morrison. Luke is a technology and digital recruitment specialist. And when I asked Luke to describe his superpower, he said, "It is his resilience and transformative ability to turn personal challenges into empowering opportunities." Hello, Luke. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Joe. Thank you very much for having me. What an intro.
I'm just looking forward to this because we've been chatting in the green room and you've got a fantastic story and I can't wait to hear it myself in detail and also for our guests as well. So, Luke, inclusivity in the digital age. Tell me more.
Sure. So I guess it really just comes down to a bit of my backstory and kind of what happened when I was younger, growing up and the life that I led and moving into the world of recruitment and being a father. So there's lots to it. There's lots of moving parts. And I kind of feel the journey of being at school was not great for me. The challenges I had, not understanding myself truly and deeply, to then working my way up into lots of different roles outside of recruitment, becoming a father, having a son who's neurodiverse, having a daughter. Kind of now I'm at this point in my life where I want to learn more and I want to give back to the community out there. And I guess for me, the biggest part is learning myself and learning on this journey, but also helping people like I'm helping my children at the moment understand who they are and how they can progress themselves and how they can not have limiting beliefs, really.
So you were one of those children who are messing around and not learning and in the bottom set, put in the sort of the no-hoper class. Was that you?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, yeah, it was. In all honesty, I was never very good at school. It's not the environment that I learn well in. Sat down, being spoken to for an hour, then moving on to the next class, being spoken to about stuff that really didn't engage me, was not the right environment for me to learn. And like many people, my wife is complete opposite. She loves learning in that environment. My daughter's the same. But me and my son, we are very similar where we would get distracted, disruptive, need to just set ourselves out of an environment. And yeah, unfortunately, I was the kid that didn't learn well at school, didn't get any of my GCSEs. Not for not wanting them. I definitely wanted to do well at school and I never bunked off school. Like, I was always present, but I just couldn't. It wasn't the right environment for me to excel in. And I've seen a lot in that in my son's journey, and it's something that I've become quite aware of now.
Was there a particular age that you discovered this, or was it right from infant school, if you like, year one?
Age of discovering that school wasn't the right environment for me.
Yeah. At what point did you realise that you just couldn't learn in a traditional or contemporary way at school in the same way as all the other children?
I know this sounds a bit odd, but I actually think it was probably my late 20s that I realized that. I know that sounds a bit strange. I always thought, and I'll be completely honest, I thought that I was really stupid, really dumb, because I didn't do well at school. I'd never do well in my career as I got older. So I left school with no GCSEs. I didn't go into upper education. I went straight into a building site, working on site, worked as a roofer, as a landscaper, as a tree surgeon. And it wasn't until I had my children where I thought, right, I need to be a provider and I want something different for my family now. So that's kind of where I started exploring other avenues. And after a few years, got into recruitment. And it wasn't until I was in my late 20s where I thought, actually, I'm not stupid. I learn in a different way and I have to be a hands-on practical or a visual learner, but it doesn't mean that I'm stupid. And then when my son was born and as he got older, I started seeing similar traits as to, it was like a mini me. I mean, he looks just like me. He acts just like me. And it's kind of, I kind of realized again, he's not a bad kid at all. He just struggles to learn in that environment. And it kind of solidified exactly how I felt when I first discovered that in my 20s. And it kind of kicked off from there, really. And that's kind of set me on this new journey and the trajectory of supporting people that are struggling and helping people become aware of the differences in how they learn and how they interact with people. And you shouldn't just label them straight away. Look, you know, you can't sit and you can't do this written test within an hour, so you're branded as dumb. That's kind of how I felt when I was younger. But now I realise that I can do it. I just need to do it in a different way. And it's exactly how my son learns as well.
Yeah, we went through a journey with our son, discovering that he has a form of dyslexia and some other complications within that kind of reading and processing ability. So, yeah, we discovered that probably when he was about 10 or 11. But having spent many years trying to get him to learn to read and not having much luck, and eventually had him diagnosed. And he was at private school at the time, and the private school basically sort of said to us that they weren't the best place for him. I think they were worried it was going to bring their grade average down if he wasn't able to pass his exam. So we ended up pulling them both out of that school, both our children. But yeah, it's quite a stressful time as a parent, feeling like your child isn't responding in the way you hope they would.
Yeah, and the educational system at the moment, I feel, is struggling in that sense. My son was at a school before he moved, and he liked the people there, kind of got in with the wrong crowd, similar to when I was younger, which then just had a bit of a snowball effect onto his behaviour and his learning abilities and his contributions to class. And my wife's been battling, we've been battling with the council, the West Berkshire Council, to try and get him EHCP, try and get on board with Senko and try and get him some extra help inside of school, which it's actually shocking how much of a challenge that's been. It's been really draining on my wife. I mean, it's a lot of admin, so I'm not very good on the admin side, so it's the role that she's taken with this. And it's just quite baffling how hard it is to get somebody that really needs a support. And unfortunately, it comes down to budget at the end of the day. And I understand it, but when you're in that position and it's your child, it's so frustrating to know that the needs of your child aren't being met just because of a budget. So yeah, we've been through a big ordeal with that. Fortunately, he's moved schools and he's been given the grant that he needs for that extra support and the extra help within school and within the education. And he's absolutely flying now. I mean, he's loving it and he's getting grades that he never thought he could have achieved without that extra bit of support. And it resonates with me and when I was younger, because I never had that support. And, you know, neurodiversity, ADHD, I haven't been formally assessed. I'm on the waiting list for that. But every test that we've done for my son and submitted, my wife's gone, Luke, that's you. I mean, me and my wife have been together 18 years. She knows me better than anyone. So back then I thought I was just really disruptive and I was thick and I would never amount to doing anything special in a career. And now I see my son going through that and it's just given me the hope that now that he's not going to have that limiting belief. He knows that his environment needs to be right for him to excel.
Quite common, from what I understand, for people to realise something about themselves when they're helping their children through it. You're not the first person to mention that to me.
Really?
It's a way of getting the diagnosis without getting a diagnosis. You just go, hang on a minute, that's me as well.
Yeah, I guess you see so many similarities in your children, in yourselves. You bring them up how you've been brought up and you raise them with the same morals and values as yourself. So I mean, it's easy because he looks like a mini me. It's almost like looking at a younger version of me. But yeah, I see it so much. My daughter is very much like my wife. She's very academically switched on. She finds it extremely easy to learn in a school setting. I mean, if you looked around my house at the moment, she actually wants to be a teacher. And she does mini virtual classes to a fake audience. You know, she's nearly 11 years old, and that's who she is, and that's how she wants to progress her career, and that's what she wants to do when she's older, which is great. It's very much like my wife. So we see very similar traits in both my son and my daughter.
Oh, that's fantastic. I love that. So you left school, mm-hmm. as you said, without any qualifications as such.
Yeah.
Well, not ones you were proud of. What happened then? You say you went to the building site, you started doing stuff.
Yeah, so I actually left home at 15. So right just before my exams and GCSEs were kicking off, I left home. I was kind of raised on farms when I was younger. It was hard to graft as a child. I mean, looking back, it's a fantastic life to live. But when you're in it and you're a teenager and you've made loads of friends at school and they're all going out seeing their friends and kind of building that friendship circle, and I'm on the farm working and supporting my parents or my mum, it's quite challenging. And I sort of kicked off a bit and I needed to get out. And so I left home at 15, sofa surf for a little bit. I ended up, my mum doesn't actually know this, but I ended up living on the streets for a couple of weeks while I was trying to find somewhere to live. So, you know, I lived a bit of a life up until I actually found music at the age of 17. Moved to Swindon. I was working as a roofer and I was DJing at the weekends and in the evenings. And that was kind of a bit of a self-discovery mode. I made quite a lot of friends that are older. My girlfriend at the time was nearly double my age. So I kind of started learning from others and seeing how they were kicking on with their career and what they were doing. It was all quite inspiring. And then I met my wife. I was 18, 19. Moved back to Newbury, where I live, and kind of realised then that me and my wife were getting quite serious at the time. We then had Frankie, my oldest, and that's when I realised that I wasn't where I wanted to be at that point. I wanted to be a lot further on to support. We didn't have a house or mortgage or anything like that. So that's kind of what led me into recruitment. I worked at the BBC for a IT cleaning company, started doing some business development for that business on the side, was engaging with the likes of ITV. And I was like, wow, this is cool. I enjoy this side. This is something I never knew I could do. And then I got a job in recruitment and it kind of kicked on from there. And that's when I started to really believe in myself and believe that I can achieve pretty much what I put my mind to.
Recruitment. It's quite a cutthroat business, isn't it? It's salesy, quite disciplined. So you were able to adapt to that environment quite quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's a structure that I excel in. I excel in having a day plan, and I excel in a real structured day. Cool, in the morning I'm doing this. I know I need to speak to these candidates, update them on their situation. Then I can move on to the client work, and there's KPIs and numbers to hit. I'm quite numbers driven. So it was an environment that worked really, really well for me. A lot of people it doesn't work for, and that's not an environment that best suited to them. But for me in particular, the more I was doing it, I was getting really quick wins. I got MVP of the year in the first recruitment business I worked in. I became top contract biller, and it just fueled my confidence. And it's everything that I need in a career to excel. So that's when I then moved into another business. I became a leader within that company. And after four and a half years, I thought of working within that role, I thought, actually, I need something for myself now. I understand recruitment. I've been doing it for 10 years. So that's when I braved up and set up my own business.
Wow. Wow. Jumping off that cliff and realizing it's just a step.
Yeah, that's exactly how I felt. I mean, there's, you know, millions of people that go out on their own and set up their own journey. But when you're a provider for the family and you've got a good, steady income coming in, your children are happy, and you finally got a house that you were all really proud of, to then make that jump again, it was something I had to talk about a lot with my wife and really had to dig down if this is the right choice. And do you know what, bless her, straight away she's like, look, I know you can do it from where you've come from to where you are now. I've got no doubts. If you think this is the right decision, you can, you should go and do it, and you can do it. So it's when you're in the trenches, it's not as scary as you think it's going to be, but it's making that leap in there and jumping in. That's the scary part, right?
It is, yeah. It's the fear of the unknown, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, we all face that. So you're in technology and digital. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah.
So what sort of scope is that? That's IT. That's electronics. It's STEM type.
Yeah, it's a really tough one for me because of my differences in character. I'm a bit of a magpie, so I like to, if I see something shiny, I like to jump on it. But what I'm really proud of that I've managed to do is stick within an area that I've done for 10 or so years. So web developers, software engineers, digital creative designers, product managers, that's the realm that I know and I understand, and I probably shouldn't start dipping my toe in other areas until I've completed this part of the business, and then we can add new parts. But yeah, it's a fascinating industry. You meet some fascinating people from all spectrums. You know, you get very introverted developers, you get very extroverted developers. So I really enjoy understanding on the initial call. I really enjoy that call. I've got a good feel of who this person is. I understand that they're probably not going to be like to be spoken to in this way. I'm going to have to speak to them a bit differently to get them engaged and to engage with them. And then once I'm on that journey, I can then start piecing, brilliant, well, they'll be really good for this client actually, because that client's got an amazing culture that can help support them on their journey, or they're good for the role technically, but that definitely won't be the right business for them to go into, because it's not an environment that will help them thrive. So I feel like understanding my journey and where I've come from and my son's journey, my children's journey, I can now identify blind spots in candidates when they're talking about businesses and culture they want to go into. So I can, yeah, I feel like I've got a good understanding now of how to piece that together and almost put the puzzle in the jigsaw.
You say the culture is really important, isn't it? Because I've got an IT, bit of a developer background myself, and you tend to find you're mingling with people in organisations who are creative. They're marketeers, they're HR or operations or production. And each of those different skills has a different way of interfacing with each other. And I find sometimes IT people are stereotyped into this sort of person with a long, you know, long beard, looking like Gandalf, locked in a cupboard, no dark, yeah, just feed me coffee and pizza and leave me alone. And to be honest, that's kind of how I was. You know, I didn't want to be interrupted all the time. You know, last thing I wanted was people standing over me, asking stuff. You know, and it can be quite a challenge for people who are not used to working with people who are artisans and artists and technically competent and brilliant. Because they often do think differently, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a really grey area, and it's a thin line to tread, because companies need those types of people. Company needs a developer that's really happy sitting at home, plugging away on their code, maybe working in the middle of the night and sleeping until 12 o'clock. Like, some businesses actually need that, and they have many developers or engineers in that environment that work in that manner. But it's kind of like breaking the mold, because clients would be, look, we need some diversity within the business. We've got a load of this, but we need something else. But once I put that new person into that business, how are they then supporting that individual if they're the only one that works in a certain way, or if they're the only one that's really expressive and that can communicate and, you know, is happy to jump on Slack all the time and speak to people, but nobody in the business or nobody in the team wants to talk to them? It's a real tough line to walk. Like, how do you manage that? And I guess it comes from the top. Like, you have to have really hard conversations with business owners and CEOs and directors of what is their culture, what is your culture. Like, don't tell me what you believe it to be. Like, actually, what does it feel like? Because I think you'll have a lot of interesting conversations where they explain what they want it to be. But naturally, you hear conversations, or you look on Glassdoor, you read some reviews, it doesn't sound like it's like that. So be honest with me. And once you can have those conversations, and then you can start introducing them to people that they probably would never have on their radar before, I think that's when the fun starts to happen, because that's when culture starts to change. And I've had it in previous roles where I've been a manager of you know, a recruitment team in Reading and in London. And you have these conversations with your team and you get to know everyone on an individual level. I think it's really important not to have this blanket approach to management, because that's what I've seen in the schooling system that doesn't work. You treat all of your pupils as the same. They all learn the same. Well, in reality, that is completely false. And you have to be able to break down barriers. You have to understand how does this individual thrive? How do they like to learn? How do they not like to be spoken to? And that may be completely different to Jane that's sitting across from them, but you have to have that different approach. And that's when cultures start to change. And that's when you start introducing some different varieties of people and different learning styles. And you kind of see everybody excel in their own areas. And yeah, that's where I think a great culture starts to be created.
Yeah, again, without stereotyping anybody here, there are people who interface better to the computer and less effectively to people. But then there are people who are able to interface between the deeply technical people and the less technical people. So you end up having these layers of interface where some people can translate from human to machine, and some people can't. So you have to put people where they're best, how they communicate. I remember I was at an event once and I was talking to, I think it was a business owner. He was talking about his IT staff and he couldn't understand. He said, these IT guys, they just don't fit the culture of my organization. They grab their lunch, they sit in their car. I want to take them to the pub. I want to do this. I want us to do all this network bonding at lunchtime. They want to sit in their car, eat their lunch, and they come back in. He said, I can't cope with it. I think I'm going to fire them. I'm going to fire people who want to join in. I said, you really don't get it, do you? Yeah. That makes them happy. And it's trying to incorporate, as you say, all those different needs of personality type to get the best out of people and work with them where they want to be, not demand they come where you are. Mm. Your culture, actually. Culture is evolved amongst everybody. No one owns it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's probably more of a selfish requirement of what that individual wanted out of his team rather than what the team wanted out of each other. You know, you see it, especially in recruitment. I mean, it's got its pros and its cons, and, you know, people have got some great things to say about recruiters and some terrible things, unfortunately, like many industries, I guess. I got into recruitment fairly late in my life compared to many others around me. I was in a business where I was the only one with children. I didn't want to go out drinking all the time because I've kind of had a life of alcohol before. And I was kind of frowned upon and looked at like, you know, look, you're a manager in the business. You need to be going out with your team. You need to be doing this. And it's actually like, that's not what I want to do. Speaking to the team, some really enjoyed and wanted to do that. Some really didn't. So then we started creating a world where, cool, well, we'll go and do this time and we'll go and do this another day, because, you know, you start then changing your environment, you're changing needs for other people, and then you're becoming more flexible. And that's really, really, I guess people really value that as a leader and value that as a business. You know, a sales culture and in recruitment, we had lots of people that were Muslim that didn't drink. And that was a bold step for a manager to go out drinking with them. And it's kind of like, mate, is that the right thing to be doing with your team where you've got people in there that don't drink? And so, well, a lot of the people do. It's like, okay, but how do you create a safe environment where they feel like they should be there and they don't want to go home early or they don't want to attend? It's tough, but you have to be brave and you have to make some brave decisions. And I think you've got to put your selfish needs to one side and really listen to your team and get to know them.
That's a really good point. I gave up drinking. I stopped drinking 945 days ago. Not that I'm counting.
Good.
It's incredible the amount of life and work, business that revolves around drinking in some way, whether it's you're meeting in the pub, you're watching the football, you're watching the Olympics, whatever it may be. And suddenly you realize when you don't drink how you often feel excluded, because why would I want to go and spend an evening with a lot of people who are drinking? Because after about an hour it becomes really tedious and I can't drink that much water or that much lemonade or whatever it may be. So yeah, it does exclude. And people who are, for whether it's chosen a faith or a need to stop drinking, often our workplaces are places where drinking is still centered as part of the culture. It's a bit like smoking was 15, 20 years ago, where to be in the in crowd, you had to be in the smoking group outside in the pouring rain, smoking with each other. That was kind of the place to be with the boss who smoked, wasn't it? And things happen in the drinking zone as well. Yeah, deals are done.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've congratulations on your sober journey, by the way. That's really good stuff. I've dipped in and out of alcohol ever since I was a teenager. When I was DJing and working and working on site, it was full of builders that went to the pub at, you know, middle of the day, and then I would go out into clubs, still where you could smoke in a club, and I'd be smoking and drinking. My life was consumed by alcohol and, you know, other parts that come with that lifestyle. When I had my children, I kind of knew the effects it was having on me being a dad, being a good husband. It took me a long time to get to where I am now, where I finally decided to stop completely. I would do 6 months here, 9 months there. I'd go on a real big health kick. In the back of my mind, I always thought, well, Christmas is coming up, so I'll drink at Christmas and then I'll be drinking again. It's fine. So I was always working to a milestone. About 4 months ago, I decided to pack it in, and I have had no regrets whatsoever. I mean, I've got no milestone in my mind that I'm going to drink. I'm going on holiday with the family in a few weeks, and it's not even on my radar to have a drink right now. I'm beyond that. This is a turning point in my life, because personally, it's no good for me. Lots of people can have the odd drink here or there and it doesn't affect them. I am all or nothing. I've demonstrated that in a lot of things that I do in my life. So for me, I have to make that decision. It's really tough at work, because I wanted to do this. It was really tough in employment, actually, is probably a better way to put it, because I wanted to give out alcohol when my kids were born. But working in the sales environment, you know, I wanted to progress. I wanted to show the managers and the business owners that I was committed. Along with that comes turning up to events, being fun, being engaging, not being the odd one out. So you end up drinking loads and loads and loads. And it actually wasn't achievable, which is sad. I think that's really sad. I actually interviewed somebody for my business a couple of weeks ago, and he's a young lad who, similar journey to me, but he's identified it really early. He doesn't want to be involved in a culture that it's drinking. And he's actually left that business and joined another really good recruitment business off the back of that. And that was a moment where I thought, these are the types of people that I want to hire. I want to hire people that understand who they are, or I don't want to put anybody in an environment where they don't feel safe, or they feel like they have to be somebody that they're not to fit in. So that was a real sort of standing point where I thought, wow, that's given me a good understanding now of what I want the company to be. But also it gives you a good insight as to how poorly people are doing it at the moment.
I remember I was invited to a 3-day reunion weekend, probably about a couple of years ago. And the person sent through this agenda, and it started off with gin tasting, then there was wine tasting, there was whiskey tasting. Then it went on to lunch, pre-dinner drinks, bottle of wine per head with the meal, aperitifs, whiskey, whatever. And I just wrote back and said, look, I don't want to be miserable or upset anybody or make it a big deal, but it doesn't sound like it's for me. The whole agenda has alcohol as part of the agenda item. So it's not an afterthought. It's kind of driven by it. And they came back and said, well, we can do a different cost if you're not drinking. I said, no, you missed the point. It's the fact that everything is centered around alcohol being a core part of the program. And that's just not for me. And I don't want to put myself in an environment where I'm sitting around watching people get drunk, because that's what happens. And we know the behavior changes after a couple of glasses. So I now actively take myself out of those spaces, in the same way that when I gave up smoking, I actively took myself out of spaces where people smoked. You know, if people were going to have this meeting outside in the smoking area, or if I was with a group of friends in the pub at the time, and they said, we're going to go for a cigarette, I'd say, go on then. I'll stay in the pub. I'm not going to join you. I'm not going to add me to you to go and socialise where you want to socialise. So how about you hang on here with me? Oh, no, I need a cigarette. So I think we've got to start taking a stand as non-drinkers, and even saying, I can give you a Beck's Blue or a Peroni 00 or something like that. Yeah, I'll have that if I'm in an event where that's the option. But I won't be looking forward to go, oh, look, I can have a zero beer tonight. Yeah, I'm looking for So I go for a different reason now. But the thing I learned about it, about myself, is that I now make smarter, better choices. It's 10 o'clock. I'm feeling tired. I'm going to go home. when I was drinking, it was like, how many more can I squeeze in before the last train? Oh, God, missed the last train. Where can I stay tonight? Oh, well, we'll go clubbing then. I'll find somewhere later. And then you end up sleeping on Waterloo Station, gripping onto your laptop with a cup of coffee in one hand and your laptop and a pillow in the other hand, waking up with a lap full of cold coffee and no trains left because you've fallen asleep, missed everything. So I've been there, and I've got so many friends who tell these stories of me, and they always revolve around being drunk or being silly or being whatever, and centered on alcohol. I got to the point in my life where I didn't want my life to be remembered by as a drinker in that way.
Mm.
And both of our children have a story about me being drunk on holiday in places. And I thought, blimey, you just take a one-eyed look at yourself. That's not who I want to be. And I think, again, going back to what I said earlier, as a society, in the world of work, we center alcohol in the same way you used to center smoking and alcohol. We've moved on from smoking. Let's move on from alcohol being the center, because it does exclude. It's still the in place to be in the pub, which is why many women feel excluded, because many of my female friends do not want to go to the pub or more than for half an hour, because it gets messy. Things change. And it's not a safe space in a drunken environment for many women and many other people as well. But yeah, women especially. And they plan their nights out around it. And if business is being done in those environments, people are going to be excluded. I think we've got to change our relationship, haven't we?
Yeah. Well, the trouble is, I mean, our society here in Britain is so... alcohol is such a big... And when I get stopped drinking, I've never proclaimed that I'm going to keep harping on about it and, you know, telling everyone about my journey. But as we've discussed it, I think it's important to mention our society is built up around alcohol, and it is a huge part of everyday life. I mean, I've got friends that don't deem themselves as alcoholics, and they'll drink every day a couple of beers, which is fine, but it doesn't affect their life. And that I could never do that. It doesn't affect their life. They can still go on and achieve great things and, you know, families and all sorts. I really struggle with, are we ever going to get past this point? I'm seeing more and more sober people than I've seen before. I think there's a lot more people becoming aware of it, seeing the benefits in others. I mean, I could talk all afternoon about the benefits of not drinking alcohol, but as a society, it's so embedded into who we are now. I can't see it changing more than it is now. The pubs are getting more expensive. It's probably going to stop people drinking a bit more. I get that. But it then bleeds into the workspace, and how do you create an environment where people can have alcohol for the ones that do want to go out on socials and that, you know, they do drink? And then how do you create that environment for the ones that don't want that without excluding one another? It's a real tough one. I don't know the answer. I'm still early into this journey, of course, but I definitely feel like you need to understand everyone on a deeper level, get to know them individually, get to know what they want, what they don't want, and then coming up with ideas that, you know, maybe go out and do an event that doesn't involve it. And the ones that want to crack on and do that and drink in the evenings, go and drink in the evenings, because I guarantee the sober ones want to go home at 9 o'clock or 8 o'clock and see their families and relax. So that's where I am now.
Yeah, I agree. And I think one of the things you can do as an organisation is make a stand and say, nothing we ever organise will have alcohol included. Alcohol can be an option. You can go and buy it yourself. But the business will no longer fund alcohol purchases. Mm. And that includes expenses policies, you know, zero tolerance to alcohol on expenses. You know, a drink with a meal is not alcohol. Mm. And as soon as businesses start taking that very proactive attitude, alcohol will always be included and paid for by the business. Yeah. Therefore, people always abuse it. I mean, I've got a gold star in abusing expenses policies with alcohol, abusing parties. I'm not trying to play whiter than white here. I've been that person who's collected trays of shots while it's still happy hour free at the bar, put them under the table, and the whole table ends up collecting alcohol, so you've got free drinks all night. I've been that person. And I'm not proud of that, but I look back on it and think, well, that was the culture that was there. Everyone was doing it. And I guess the organisation, the company, knew that they were going to end up with a 30K alcohol bill, but it all seemed to be worth it. So, yeah, we've got to start having zero tolerance and organise things that aren't based around alcohol. Until we do.
That's the right thing to do.
Yeah. Because it ruins people's lives. And I'm not being that as a reformed drinker. I'm not trying to implant my perspective on everybody else. But yeah, it does ruin people's lives. You know, we see, I was just to put a date stamp on this recording, we had the race riots a couple of weeks ago, in the last 10 days. And I've seen some of the stories about people who are charged and imprisoned as a result of it. And some of them just literally walked out the pub. All their mates are going, come on, get out here. They're all fueled up, drinking. And suddenly their life has changed because they made the wrong decision after a few drinks. Mm. And we know that it removes your objectiveness and your decision-making power.
Yeah.
Drinking and driving and other things.
I genuinely believe nothing good comes from alcohol. I can't put one point in my life where alcohol has contributed to any success or any positives in my life. I can't. Okay, there may be nights where I had a really good time, I had a good laugh, but I have some great times with my friends not drinking. I went on a stag do not too long ago, and it was really tame. Don't get me wrong, it wasn't a stag do. We're all, you know, late 30s now, but it was. I had an amazing meal. I sat there. I had two alcohol-free Guinnesses, and I drank water or Diet Coke for the rest of the night. And I came home, and I was so happy and proud of myself that I managed to have a great night with great friends, not drunk. And I woke up the next day, I did what I needed to do. I was present for my family. I was there for my children. I'm doing more and more with my family now than I ever done. But it's because the most important thing to me right now is family. The second most important thing is getting my business off the ground and making it a success for my family. Mm. And I can't do that whilst I'm drinking alcohol, because it then consumes me as a person. And all I end up doing is being an alcoholic, in a sense.
Yeah, having a hangover, waiting for the next drink. Yeah. That's kind of how it was, yeah.
Absolutely.
So if you're at a different stage of your life where it helps you relax, helps you, then fine. I'm not here to police you, as you aren't. But sometimes you just need to step back and look at your life.
Yeah.
And work out how much of it is consumed or dominated by having a drink. And then when you stop, it really is noticeable how much everything revolves. And the other thing, my wife and I were trying to lose weight, so you realize how much life revolves around eating and drinking.
Mm-hmm.
As part of your socialization. I guess it's a human thing. So yeah, it does dominate your life. And
yeah,
so many Saturday mornings and Sunday mornings that I can get out of bed till midday, or then feeling rough afterwards, and then you have another drink, still feel rough, you drink through it.
Yeah. It's a forever going cycle, though, isn't it? That's the trouble. Mm. And it's until you brave up and you go, well, I don't want this anymore. If you've known for a long time that it's not something you want to keep doing, when you finally get to that point and you break it, okay, it's a bit scary, it's a bit daunting at the time, and you know, you think that people are going to look at you differently or treat you differently. I feel like that's their own insecurities, rather than, you know, they're probably a bit jealous, because I think a lot of people would love to stop drinking, but just as part of the society, they can't. When you do that, you realise how easy it is, actually, and how much more life you get back. I remember James Corden talking about alcohol. I can't remember exactly what it was, but he would say whenever he drinks one day, he gives a day back to alcohol. So it's 2 days gone of his life because of the hangovers. I mean, my hangovers I'd have a couple of pints on a Sunday and I'd feel it until Wednesday. So my hangovers were a lot longer, but you give that life away to the alcohol. And I've got that life back, and I've got that time back. So now I'm putting it into the family and into the business. And it's, you know, it feels like the perfect time to stop, definitely.
Do you think your ADHD or neurodiversity fueled that kind of addictive behavior? Was it, could you blame, I'm not saying blame it on that, but can you see a sign where it was that all or nothing?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, it's not understanding my son's neurodiversity and that. The way that he is with things, he is very much all or nothing. I am all or nothing. And it is a big part of ADHD. So when I get into something, I get into it. I'm not a fad where I'll do lots and lots of different things and, you know, jack of all master or none. I will put all my time into the thing that I love at the time. Same with golf. Like I love golf. That is my hobby. That's my time away. When I was in the gym a lot, doing bodybuilding, I was, you know, that was my thing at the time. But I've always kept golf and gym in my life. Alcohol is something that I just couldn't couldn't do a little bit of. I say it to my friends all the time. They're like, surely you can just sit here and have one beer. I was like, I could, of course I could, but I will go home and I'd want another beer. And then it's taken over my weekend. And I've lost my weekend to alcohol. My family's lost their dad to, you know, being down the pub with his friends. It's just not important to me. And now I've realized this, and now I've understood who I am as a person. And I'm still on that journey. I'm still very infant into understanding who I am. But now I'm on this journey, I realize what's good for me and what's bad for me, and how addictive I can get to situations and alcohols. And it is part of neurodiversity and ADHD. I definitely, a lot of people that drink that have ADHD shouldn't drink, because it is an addictive trait. So yeah, I would definitely pass it on to that. blame ADHD.
Well, no, but it's all part of that hyper focus. It's all part of that. I mean, I know I can't. I can have none, but I can't have one. Yeah. One is 10.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or feeling that you need 10. Even if I have one and I have to leave, it's like, oh, one more. You'll finish somebody else's off. You know, that's the worst thing.
Yeah. Do you know what I've given up recently as well? Because I'm now on this journey of healthiness and, you know, being healthy as I grow older and being there for my family. Mm. I've actually given up coffee. And it is... that I was as shocked with giving up coffee and the effects it had on my body than I was when I gave up alcohol. I mean, my focus now, and I do struggle with focusing at work when I'm on my own in my office and I'm you know, grinding it out, trying to get the business up and running. Coffee, and if I would sit and maybe have 6-7 cups of coffee a day, now I don't drink it, and I'm through that period of not drinking it. I'm 2 months now. I am so much more focused at work. I sleep a lot better. I had no idea. But again, it's an ADHD thing. You know, if you've got that type of personality, you shouldn't really be drinking coffee or drinking alcohol, because you can get addicted to it. And you can end up, you know, it can change who you are and how you work.
Yeah, we share another similar thing. I gave up caffeine, but about... Eight years ago.
Did you?
I, being with an IT background, it was almost like you'd been working all night, it engrossed in something. You'd stand up go to the toilet, get a coffee, or you wait for something to compile, or wait for something to load, or doing something like that. You go and grab a coffee, or out in the old days, have a cigarette, have a coffee. And then I remember walking around Sainsbury's about 8 or 9 years ago, and I remember I felt really, really uncomfortable in my chest. I felt really kind of like I was palpitating. And I started doing some analysis of this and realized that it was coffee. It happened before when I had a Red Bull weekend a few years before, but I realized that coffee did it. So now I drink decaf. I still drink too much decaf. But if I have a full strength coffee now, I can feel it. If I have two, I start feeling my chest is going funny. I start feeling hyper. I feel kind of really uncomfortable. And so, yeah, I know what caffeine does to me now, whether I've developed an intolerance to it over my life or whether I'm just masking it because I'm doing so much of it. But yeah, I have a very high or low threshold of tolerance for caffeine now.
Well, you get used to it after time, don't you? Your body becomes numb to the effects of it. Same as alcohol and, you know, any substance that you do more and more and more of, you become used to it and it doesn't have the same effect. So I refuse to have a coffee now because of the headaches that I got after stopping. I mean, I had 3 or 4 days of, in the middle of the night, pounding. I was googling it, which you should never do when you've got a headache. Don't ever google anything like that. And then I kind of, so the reason why I stopped is when we had that first heat wave about 2.5 months ago, and I couldn't drink hot drinks. I was like, no, I'm going to give it a rest. And then it got to Sunday and my head was pounding, and Laura was like, have you changed anything in your diet? Like, she was getting quite worried. And then I was like, actually, I haven't drunk coffee for four or five days. And then she's like, I reckon it's that. And then we looked at it, and because it restricts the capillaries in your brain to stop the blood flow, which is why when you stop, your capillaries open up, and that's when you get the headaches. So I was like, well, I'm not going to drink it now. If it's been I struggle enough as it is with my brain getting blood in now. Don't want to add to that. So yeah, I gave it up after the back of that.
Fascinating. Yeah, it's really the aspect we can share. Any other stories? We've both got addictive personalities. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah. But I think it just takes something in your life. And as you've said eloquently many times, it's around finding that focus about your family.
Mm.
You're turning your hyper-focus, if you like, on
absolutely,
on your social side, your family side, getting pleasure and satisfaction out of the love of your family, which you can't do that when you have another monster taking over.
Yeah. It's a really nice way to frame it, actually, because I always look at myself, oh, maybe I'm never happy enough. Like, I'm always looking for the next thing. Like, that's part of my personality. But actually framing it, like, my hyper-focus now is my family. That's a I've not thought about it like that before. That's a really nice way to look at it. And I look at the challenges my children have had. You know, even my wife, she's in a brilliant role. She's worked at a great company for a long time. She left to take a step up in her career and with a new company. And unfortunately, it didn't go to plan. Her manager left. She was left with lots of stuff on her plate. And it threw her downward spiral. She was off work. She's never been off with panic attacks or that anxiety. She was in a really dark place for a long time. And that was it's like a commitment now. I want to build something so she doesn't have to work, so she can do something that she really loves doing. I know she loves her role now, but I want to create a life for my family that is special. And I think understanding my family and where they've been and my children, I really believe that we can help that with other people looking for jobs and companies that are hiring and taking my experience with speaking to incredible people that are perfect for their business because of their culture, not just because of their technical skills. I think there's some really nice nuances within there that I can help match that. I'm still on this journey. It's still very early for me. I've got lots and lots to learn, and, you know, podcasts like this and speaking to people like yourself really help contribute towards that. But yeah, it's I feel like it's the right time for me. I'm maturing finally as a person.
I think that we all go through, but some of us go through it later in life, where you finally start to understand the game of life. You realize what it really is all about, what the important things, what the things you'll grow to regret that you didn't do, rather than the things you do sometimes. And looking back and saying, actually, that I don't want to keep repeating the same things I'm doing. Actually, what I want is this. And it's almost reframing. You don't have a work-life balance. You have a life balance that allows you to live your life and then feed that with what you need to succeed. You know, I talk about, I'm much more comfortable talking about sufficiency now rather than gluttony. I went through a phase of my life where I was gluttonous, if you like. I wanted bigger cars. I wanted to compete. I wanted more of this, more of that, more of the other. I'm not saying I still don't buy things. I still buy things, but it's not about competing. I buy it because I want it, because I enjoy it, and I'll get some benefit out of it, not because it's the biggest one or the newest one. I'm driving a 17-year-old car, and I love it. I own it outright. I don't owe anybody anything, apart from the tax on a monthly basis. But yeah, it's mine outright, whereas in the past, I had to have the latest. I've had X5s. I've had 4-series convertibles and turbo this and turbo that. Because it seems to be what's right now. Say sufficiency is kind of a model I'm happy with. Have I got sufficient for now and next week and maybe next month? That's all I care about.
It's confidence in what you're looking for and what you want, isn't it? Really, I mean, you're confident that actually you don't want to be chasing the big cars and all that, because it's not important to you and who you are and what you're about. You know, as a salesperson, you'd have your Lambos and your Ferrari stuck up on your board behind your computer and all that kind of stuff. And I've had nice cars, and that stuff isn't important to me. It's, you know, I drive an electric car. It was good because it's through the business. You get a tax relief off it, which is why we got it. But what's important to me is making sure my wife's pension is maxed out when we're older, and my children's pensions are maxed out if I can. And, you know, if I can put the effort in now, you know, I could get to a point, hopefully, when I'm in my 50s, that my wife can, she knows that she's got a full pension maxed out for her. That's the goal for me, and that's what I want to do. I want to be able to support my family.
And that isn't that the I call this the definition of freedom. Freedom is the ability to make a decision about what you want to do, the freedom of choice, knowing that you have the means and the support and the whatever it may be, the sufficiency around you to do that. So what you're trying to say is you want yourself, your wife, your family to have freedom of choice at this point in their life to do whatever they want to do. And if that is stay in work, stay in work. If it's not, if it's do this, go traveling, sit in the sun all day. It's all part of building that freedom, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, growing up on the farm, my mum worked very hard and, you know, she had three boisterous boys at the age of 18 and we, you know, we were rough and tumble kids and she did what she could. I mean, she's had an amazing career. She's got a brilliant business. She's winding down for retirement. You know, really proud of what she's achieved and I want to be able to achieve that now for my family. I mean, it's going to take me a long time, don't get me wrong. I'm not baffled and deluded and, you know, this time next year it'll all be happy. We've been going close to two years now, so I think I've got another 10 years of hard graft until I can sit back and see the plan evolving. But yeah, that's what I want them to have, that flexibility and freedom. And it's not something that I had when I was younger. No fault to my mum, who was trying to do the best she could for us. But it's given me that motivation, and it's especially, you know, being so close to my family and really being present with them now, it's even more of a driver.
You talked about culture and when you're working with organisations around trying to place candidates, persuade candidates this is the right opportunity for them, persuade the opportunity this is the right candidate for them. Are you seeing in the sort of the tech sector that you work in, the digital sector, representation of a broader demographic, or is it still the usual suspects? Are we seeing a broader gender balance? Are we seeing a broader ethnicity balance? Or are we still stereotyping into the traditional candidates?
We are definitely seeing a broader ethnicity balance, definitely. I feel gender balance, it's on people's radars, but I don't think they've got strong enough initiatives to support that. I think businesses want to have a less of a gender gap, it's probably a good way to put it, but they're unsure of how they can do that. How can they attract females or males, whichever way there's the imbalance? So I definitely feel, yeah, I feel like it's on their agendas, but it's so early into their journey, they haven't really created something substantial to onboard them. Like how are they going to support a new female developer in an all male business? Like what are you doing to support that person coming on board? How are you going to stop all the conversations based around football or, you know, whatever gender topics pop up? It's
yeah, the lad culture, the bro environment sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm speaking to more and more people, and especially since setting up the business, that lots of clients have come to us and it's something that they want help with and they want our support on. But I don't know if a lot of them are actually ready for it. So a lot of the conversations we've had, I'm like, are you saying it because it's a tick box exercise, or are you actually truly needing to change this because the culture is so bad and because you want the business to evolve? So it's digging down on that topic and really understanding their needs and their situation. I am worried that some companies do it as a tick box exercise, which is a bit sad, but I've spoken to some brilliant companies the last few months that it is part of their agenda and they're driven to change. So I feel like it's moving in the right direction. I don't know how you would see it from when you were working within that world, but it's probably changed a lot.
I think it mirrors what you're saying. Is there's a lot of willingness out there, but a lot of it is, I would say, passive. They're kind of expecting it to fix itself, or they're just magically expecting more women, for example, to apply for a role, and they don't. You go, well, okay, no worries, we'll just hire one of the men. So there's a lot of passive. There's not a lot of what we call active, deliberate targeting, you know, positive action campaigns, looking at their recruitment marketing, their employer brand, sorting out their own culture first, and having honest conversations with young women saying, it's a bit of a lad culture at the moment. We're trying to change it. We need your help. Are you prepared to give it a go with us and work with us on this? We have your back, because nobody wants to be the first, and that's the tough one, isn't it? If you're brought in as the first and the only, we see so many examples of women coming into those environments, and then it's just not fair on them. The culture isn't evolving around them.
That's the point that needs to be made. It's like when you do when you do change the culture and when you do start becoming more inclusive and thinking outside of the realms of what they deem as norm and hiring some good talented female engineers or, you know, whatever that inclusive piece that's missing is, how is that person going to feel when they join this business? Are you just trialing it out to then make the people have got to understand these aren't just CVs, they're actual people behind these CVs. So you may have an initiative, you may want to bring some females on board, but once you do bring one on, it's almost like trial and error. It's like that's not the right way to be doing it. When you mentioned to me just then, you kind of said, like, look, it has a real honest conversation. We need your help. We are struggling. We want to do this. We want you to run with it. That's the best type of conversation you can have with somebody in that situation, because they're showing they're vulnerable. They know they've got a problem and they're looking for help and support to get them through this period. My piece of advice would be hire more than one at one go. Hire a select range of people all at once, all different ethnicities, female, gender, whatever. That's what I would do. But don't just hire one person as a trial and error piece and see if it works. And then, you know, because there's a lot of change and there's a lot of work to do in the background to make sure that individual feels safe and they feel comfortable and they feel that they're wanted and they're needed.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it's, you say, if you bring several people in together, even if it's one woman and two men, you're diluting the norm. You're disrupting the current culture and creating a new culture by the number of people. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think if you start day one and you're the only one, if you start day one and you're one of five, then you have a chance to have new allegiances. You can build mm-hmm. bonds and relationships with those people as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it doesn't necessarily have to be five women, but...
No, absolutely.
And five different people. Yeah.
They're the future of the next generation of the business, right? So if they're all onboarded together and it's not just one singular, it's a group of new employees and they're all together, and if you match the culture, and this is what's really important, is making sure you find the right people for the right culture. If you can match the right people, not just the CV to fill a void, like that's what we try and do, is like that this, you've spoke to me about your culture, this is what works inside, feel this person can benefit and actually the culture is good for them and they, you know, vice versa. They're on that journey together. So 5 years down the line, the norm of, you know, that's the norm for them. All the people that have been in the business longstanding prior may have left. And then there's more people coming through the ranks. That's how culture changes. You can't change it overnight. It is a long, lengthy process, but you've got to stay committed and you've got to be humble enough to accept what's working and what's not. I mean, it's got to be committed.
I agree. Yeah, for sure. Luke, it's been absolutely fascinating. You know, I said at the beginning, when we're in the green room, that about an hour in, I'd say, what a fantastic conversation. And I was right. It has been amazing. How can people get hold of you?
Sure. So I guess the best place would be on our website. So it's www.holistix.io. That's holistix.io. Catch us on LinkedIn. If you're looking for work, you're struggling with internally for culture, I'm always happy to help and have conversations.
Fantastic. Or if you want to share your neurodiversity and experience with ADHD, your alcohol abstinence, yeah. Coffee problems, like we have today, reach out to either of us. We're both accomplished experts on abstinence I don't know, performance changing drugs, I guess they are. Alcohol and caffeine. Luke, it's been an absolute pleasure. I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Joe.
As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you, our listener, for lending your ear and heart to the cause of inclusion. If today's discussion struck a chord, consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change. Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts, stories, or a vision to share? I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.